and the continental system via Canada. I think it's truly unfortunate because the Canadians will have a competing railhead, probably one more efficient than our own, and undoubtedly will attract capital to Canada because of the greater efficiency. I would hope that this panel might somehow influence the United States development policy in Alaska to include consideration of the connection between the Alaska Railroad and the Continental System via Alaska in the upcoming $6.2 million transportation study. Now, one condition that hasn't been mentioned so far is the fact that probably Alaskans are the wealthiest citizens of the United States in terms of natural wealth available for their manipulation and use, conservation. Yet, the overall economic standard of living in Alaska is well below the national average. Now, surely this does not represent very good public planning. And somehow, the Alaskans should be able to bring up their economic standard of living at least equal to that of the nation. This pipeline will provide low-cost energy over an 800-mile route. Now, if that low-cost energy is combined with highway transportation, and rail transportation, and adequate water, and with the minerals that are available in the state, there should be ample opportunity for industrial development along that pipeline route. Yet I know of no planning that's being done to take advantage of this very fortunate combination of water, transportation, and power. This needs to be done. Again, I would hope that this federal panel would be able to influence federal policy to the extent, and possibly state policy to the extent, that there would be prepared a comprehensive, long-term, perhaps general, development plan for the entire state of Alaska that would include social, economic, and physical considerations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. The next witness is Charles Edwardson, Jr., President, Friends of Alaska Natives.
I'm Charles Edwardson, Jr., born and raised at Point Barrow, Alaska, and now presently in Washington, D.C., with a small nonprofit educational research corporation oriented on Alaska Natives. And all of us have heard the opposition of development of Alaska, or have heard pro-development of Alaska. But the fact is that there are some people in Alaska called Alaska Natives. Where have they been? What role have they had? We've seen rape, continual rape. Along with rape, we've seen introduction of diseases. We've seen a whole culture being continually raped at the cost of an almighty buck. What are we doing for them? Or are we doing anything with them? And here is another crash program, along with the Alaska Natives is also rest of the Alaskan citizens. And I've seen the development, and fortunately and unfortunately, my education has been very painful. I went out and have learned these educational techniques by going to school, by just doing a lot of things. And Alaska Native is still behind. Now there's oil. We've known that oil has been up there. We've called in all of the technical expertise which has been needed to take this oil out. But what are we going to do next with the Alaska Natives? Are we going to keep them there? Is that their place in life? Are they going to be re-ignored again? This is not only Alaska Natives, by the very circumstance of the muscle and all the economic interest that is going to be invested with oil and its power, influence throughout the nation, and with the instability of the United States and our foreign policy with other oil developing countries. Now we know that there is oil reserve in Alaska. We also know too that the political stability of our internal government versus Peru's, Venezuela, Middle East is hot. Now we have a known reserve at home. But home for a lot of my people are shacks. And on top of oil, there's a native land question. We have moved and exercised the rightful ownership of our lands. But over these lands, we still have poverty. Why do we have poverty? Is because that we have ignored certain groups of people. Because the source of poverty and source of the type of economic institution which we have chosen is how do we manage scarce things. And with the management of scarce things and holders of these commodities, whether it's in fisheries, we saw it in fisheries. Take a look at southeastern Alaska. We saw it in whaling interest. We saw it with the development of the military industrial complex in Alaska has been painful. Painful for Alaska Natives. And here is we have some great social problems which we are going to face. And most of us are not willing to recognize that some of these internal problems are the very nature of circumstance of the type of tack that we use. We will say, the Eskimo is lazy, or the Indian is lazy. All he wants to do is be the part of the welfare system. But this is not really so. But what has been real is we have been kept outside of the system. This is, we are and is a psychological hang up for some of our own incompetence. Incompetence of failures of administration after administration. Failure to recognize self-dignity of man. This is failure to recognize that he is a man. An Alaska Native, whether he's an Aleut or an Indian, is a man. And this failure has been institutionalized in our existing social political system. And we can talk about conservation. If you cannot conserve the Eskimo or the Indian, who are you going to conserve next? That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Edwardson. The next witness is Rick Gordon, Juneau, Alaska. Let the record show that there's no response from Mr. Gordon. Oh, I'm sorry.
My name is Richard Gordon from Juneau, Alaska. I am representing myself. Secretary Train, members of the panel, I have two premises in what I'm going to say. First of all, that orderly and carefully regulated oil and concurrent mineral development is in the best interest of all concerned, though this will inevitably cause losses. It's justifiable that the oil companies earn profits on their investment and their stockholders earn profits. And more importantly, it is very desirable that sufficient funds come into the state of Alaska so that the citizens of this state, particularly the underprivileged and the needy, can have adequate programs, adequate means of support, help, and good planning. However, second, coordinated area-wide planning for all of Northern Alaska and all of Alaska as one fabric is absolutely essential. Both development and protection, including areas of preservation, must be planned for together. A perspective, a proper frame of reference, a granting of priorities as to what government resources are applied, where they're applied, when they're applied, how they're applied, must be planned for. Pipeline planning in itself, by itself, is not acceptable. My reasons for saying this are that people are, in most areas in the Arctic and Northern Alaska right now, they're having an effect on wildlife. For example, a recent letter from Bud Helmerichs, a big game guide on the Colville, reports that for the first time in many years, he has not seen the grizzly bears and the wolves and the wolverines that he usually sees around his home. This, I think, is a sample. I've seen another letter from another inhabitant of the North saying the same thing. Second, as transportation paths are developed, the use of tracked vehicles will inevitably spread people, they already are, from the oil camps throughout the tundra, throughout the Muskeg. So planning must go from one end of northern Alaska to the other, and particularly in lands that are now owned by the BLM, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the state. In a word, what we need is coordination. We need adequate studies. This has been said by many people many times. This needs more time. We've only had a very short field season planned for on a crash basis. We need to give people like the ecologists here who are working for both the oil, major oil companies, time to continue their studies. We need to provide dollars and men, BLM, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. At the state level, at the federal level, we need wildlife surveys, wildlife, life history studies, habitat studies, and then continuous monitoring. We need coordination between the federal, the state, industry, and university studies. And as has been mentioned before, we need a clearinghouse of some sort so that this information can be returned to a central source, and then we need some sort of an information retrieval system so that that information can be obtained by anybody who wants it. Until such systems have been developed, I don't think it's justifiable to say we've completed any plan for the North, to say that we can justify approving a major development such as a pipeline system. We need ecological and physical research on unaffected areas. These will be the controls. We need careful studies of past effects of activity in the North. And the major ones are on the old Navy exploration in PET4, the travels and effects from dew line operations. We need to know as much as possible of the short-term effects of the recent seismic operations. And we need to know, as Dr. Pecora has pointed out, the effects and findings of Russian activity. I'm very grateful for what the USGS is doing in that regard. That information needs to be available. We need tests regarding planned and possible unplanned future modifications of the northern environment. And those tests and the analysis of the result will take more than one field season. I would emphasize tectonics, slumping, marine geophysical and biological studies in the Beaufort Sea, and in particular permafrost, as has been stated before. One particular suggestion I would have is that the oil companies, in some means or other this winter, set up a section of pipe in permafrost and under as many types of soil conditions as possible, and that they run warm fluid through it to see what actually happens. Until we actually have some evidence of the problems and the unexpected, perhaps, results, I don't think it's justifiable to go ahead and have the test be on the pipeline itself as it's built and as oil starts running through it. So we need test areas. We need participation. Charlie has just mentioned the needs of the native peoples. I would suggest that there be native peoples on the advisory board, Secretary Train's committee, as well as to Governor Miller's recent task force. I think that natives should very definitely have a say in planning what goes on the North Slope. After all, they believe it's their land, and I think they have a good deal to argue for. Some of the events on the state land selections near Prudhoe Bay have just shut out the natives, and I don't think that's right. I would have another suggestion for participation. To the best of my knowledge, and I could be wrong on this, there are no Alaskan conservationists, that is in the AC, Alaska Conservation Society, Alaska Wilderness Council, Alaska Chapter of the Sierra Club, so forth, who are members of one of the advisory citizens committees to Secretary Train's task force or to Governor Miller's task force. I would suggest that one or more conservationists be appointed to these task force. Enforcement. Dr. Glasgow has brought this up, and I think it's a key. We need funds, We need men. We need teeth in the regulations. In the stipulations we've got now, we have teeth. But we need teeth not just in regulations for the pipeline, but for all activities on the North Slope, and not just for federal activities, for state activities too, and they need to be coordinated. And then when you develop regulations such as BLM has, they need support from the higher-ups in Washington. And I think it's worthwhile to have the lawyers investigate means by which these regulations can best be enforced by the courts, because that, after all, ultimately is what's going to put the fear of God, so to speak, into the various agents that are active in the North. As far as the stipulations themselves are concerned, I think they're outstanding. They've been developed mainly by Alaskans and the Bureau of Land Management. I think that they are excellent. I do think that there are problems involved. As a long-term goal, it's desirable to internalize costs, as has been stated by economists, and I'm not one. The oil industry will be much more concerned with their own enforcement if the costs are internalized, but I have no immediate proposals for this. For the present time, the stipulations are needed. There is a problem of whether the stipulations are design or performance stipulations. The oil companies have brought this up. I think it is a problem. It is needed to have some means by which the oil companies can try out new methods. They can experiment. I would suggest that rather than doing these things on the pipeline itself, that they go back and have certain areas which are test sites, areas that we can write off, small areas, in which they can go ahead and do all sorts of experiments before starting actual pipeline construction. For the contractors, I would say the contract performance bonds are a good idea. For the major oil companies, the amounts of money involved are not significant. I think much more significant is the good intentions, the goodwill of the majors. Later, first of all, I want to comment that we have some very, very good BLM men here. I've gotten to meet some of them. I'm very, very much impressed with them. I think that's important. These Alaskan BLM people are good. There's some pretty sharp oil men, and I think that the regulations themselves can be enforced in a cooperative and common sense way by simply working together of good men in the field right here. I think they will work because the men who are working with them are good. In specifics, the one thing I would comment is that the sanitation and waste disposal specs, I think, perhaps need tightening up. I'm very concerned about burying anything whatsoever on the tundra and permafrost areas. I'm also concerned that any dumps, any areas of open pollution or even temporary dumps will attract grizzlies. Grizzlies are few in number. They have a good sense of smell, and they don't get along well with people. The best way to protect our grizzly bears is not to have open dumps. This brings up the whole matter of wildlife protection, and I do think that this is something which deserves more study in cooperation with the Department of Fish and Game. Above all, sensible but solid enforcement. As to proposals, and I realize that some of these will not be perfectly feasible at this time, some of them are more goals than they are workable proposals. And I just haven't refined this presentation enough to say which of these things are absolutely essential in total before the pipeline permit be granted and which are simply goals. I would say that the important thing is that work should be started on a planned basis with at least something written down on all of these first six items before a pipeline permit is granted. Number one, the present physical and ecological studies need to progress considerably further, certainly one winter and one more field season at the least. Two, the oil companies have to have time to test pipeline operation and concomitant development. Three, federal, state, oil, and I would suggest mineral exploration and development companies need to begin work on planning for a transportation and communication network throughout the North, including orderly procedures to be applied in continuing planning development. Obviously, we're not going to plan to continue a system to last 50 or 100 years in the next year or two. We can start planning for procedures. And I emphasize again that the state should be a part of all this. Four, The state and the BLM need to work out some sort of mechanics to allow planning for management coordination between the future state land selections and the remaining BLM lands. 5, advance agreement on road plans between TAPS, the federal government, and the state are essential. The state, as we all know, has the legal right to, by eminent domain, to claim land for a transportation route, that is a highway. But I think it's essential that some agreement be worked out between the federal government and the state and TAPS before a pipeline permit is granted, so everybody, including the public, knows what is going to happen and how it's going to happen. And 6, again, enforcement. We need constant surveillance by adequate and well-trained staff of protectors, including industry people, to police the contractors and subcontractors. Now, I have some suggestions which I would not tie directly into the pipeline. Most notable, I would suggest that the BLM be authorized to classify their lands in the Arctic. Granted, there will be state selection, but in a preliminary way, I would suggest that a classification be authorized and published before the right to classify expires at the end of next year. I think that this classification should include types of zoning. I think it should be fairly specific. It should include various degrees of allowable development. I think in most areas, mineral development exploration should be allowed, but under very close supervision. It should include areas closed to state selection, as with the Wrangell Mountain area, in order to protect potential outstanding scenic and other values. It should include primitive areas. It should include wild rivers, such as the Killick, the Chandler, the Alatna, for example. It should protect strips around lakeshores, and I think this has been a neglected point. Half of the barrels in Alaska seem to be along the lakes and river shores of our state, and many of them still leak oil. This is a big problem. The beauty of the lakeshores certainly would be improved if these barrels could be removed. I would suggest that immediate zones around lakeshores of identified lakes of special beauty, and I would suggest including most of the large lakes that are on BLM land on the edges of the Brooks Range, that all barrels and material brought into these lakes in connection with exploration for minerals or oil be removed as soon as they're no longer needed. I would suggest that no mining claims be allowed immediately along these lake shores. I would suggest that some lakes be closed entirely to all development or private alienation. Beyond that, as most of you know, there is a proposal for a national park in the Arctic. I think this is a reasonable proposal. I think that the Park Service proposal, which is on the south slope, should be extended to the north slope to include these beautiful and very different northern side of the range, particularly in the valley of the Killick River, which is a marvelous place with many lakes, lots of wildlife, and a totally different view. If you've ever seen the meeting of the so-called foothills, which are quite low and rolling, with the base of the mountains on the northern end, this is a site that can't be duplicated anywhere. I think it should be preserved. And what I'm trying to get across is that I think these things should be coordinated. I don't think that you can go ahead with development while proposals for a park, while proposals for BLM classification sit in Secretary Hickel's office or are not acted on because our congressmen and senators at this time are not too sympathetic. We should have both. If the congressional delegation from Alaska doesn't approve of classification and protection for some lands, then I would oppose a pipeline permit on that basis alone. Finally, I think that delay will indeed cause a loss to a certain extent in the oil company's investment, but I think it simply must be accepted as a part of the orderly study and development process which is required for adequate planning on the North Slope. This is a large region. I think the oil company simply must accept this as an internal cost. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Let me just comment, Mr. Gordon, in response to one of your points. By the way, I compliment you on the number of points you've made. You certainly have covered the waterfront. On the matter of advisory groups, we have, I think, made a strenuous effort to consult regularly with a wide spectrum of groups. And perhaps I'm at fault. I've avoided establishing too many formal advisory groups because it seems to me that there are so many advisory groups and committees involved in this thing, it's pretty hard to recall who's doing what. I do know that BLM does have a formal state multiple use advisory group appointed by Secretary Hickel that does include representatives of Native peoples. It does include some conservationists. I know Mrs. Celia Hunter is a member of it, and it has been a quite an active group, so, and involved in some of the work we've been talking about. And I just mentioned that in passing. Thank you very much.
Shall we take a 15-minute recess at this time?
I think we might just keep on going, and let's keep moving.
Mitchell, please not get a testify, but he's going to submit in writing before the 15th. So note that when he comes along here.
For this.
I thought it was, it's going to be, I guess he's on the right page.
He's not going to testify.
He's put down at least.
All right, the next witness is Walter Parker, Anchorage, Alaska. Would be the same as W.B. Parker. The next witness then is Stephen Reeve, Fairbanks, Alaska. Is Mr. Reeve present? Let the record show that there's no response. The next witness then is Ronald Anderson, University of Alaska student.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to postpone my testimony at this time until my name is called again so that I may hopefully make a more effective testimony
when it comes up again. Thank you. Are you saying, Mr. Reeve, that you would like to be called tomorrow rather than this evening?
I'm Mr. Anderson, sir.
Mr. Anderson.
Right. I would like to be called tomorrow.
All right. The next witness then is Mr. George Gilson, Mayor Valdez, Alaska.
Mr. Mitchell, the people are coming up from Valdez tonight. I don't think they'll be here tomorrow.
All right, sir. The next witness then is Mr. John Miller, ESRO Station Director, Fairbanks, Alaska. Is Mr. Miller present? Let the record show there's no response. The next listed witness is Dr. Ronald Smith, Fairbanks, Alaska. Is Dr. Smith present? Let the record show there's no response. The next listed witness is Hans Vanderlaan, Anchorage, Alaska.
Since I spoke this morning as representative of the conservation group, I wish to make my own statement. However, in the interest of time, I will file it as a written statement.
Thank you very much.
You will file a statement as an individual within the coming 15-day period. The next listed witness is Marie Lindstrom, Anchorage, Alaska.
She gave a testimony earlier. I was originally
She has previously offered written testimony. The next listed witness is Lawrence R. Mayo, Fairbanks, Alaska.
My name is Lawrence R. Mayo, L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E, R. Mayo, M-A-Y-O. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. Speaking as a private citizen, you should know that I'm a hydrologist for the Geological Survey, and this is to be in no way a report of the Geological Survey. Mr. Chairman and panel, I'd like to address you tonight on an issue that is central to both the conservation and industry, one that has been covered very inspecifically by the stipulations, and that is the integrity of the pipeline. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline people have done an excellent job in considering the integrity of that pipeline, and some features of their work not being covered in the stipulations I feel should be, to ensure that this excellent consideration of the pipeline integrity is carried forward into the years hence. A first order hazard to persons, property, natural environment, and corporate profits exists from pipeline deformation, which could lead to eventual pipeline failure. During planning, construction, and maintenance, a primary concern is with pipeline integrity. And fundamental to pipeline integrity is a data collection system to detect pipeline deformation or failure. Even so, the proposed stipulations do not touch on any data system, which is the prerequisite to proper maintenance. The objective of this report is to identify the most important sources of potential deformation, outline a proper data system, and to propose a specific stipulation. Some important potential deformations. Very slow deformation, that is strain that can occur over years of time, are breaking it down into either natural or induced. Natural deformation can occur from soil creep, or from solifluction, or from very slow block slumping. All three of these are known along much of the pipeline route. As an example, up to 7 feet of slow block slumping has occurred in the Copper River Basin. This was found out as a result of the first order releveling network done after the 64 earthquake. Induced very slow deformation can occur from melting of large ice masses in the subgrade. No matter how well we explore for ice masses in the subgrade, I think it's naive to assume that all of them will be discovered. Creep or slumping from thawing or water diversion can occur. Induced frost or frost heaving of piling in the raised portion of the pipeline could occur. Moderate deformation, that is strain that could be reported as some strain per day or per week. Natural strain consists of mass movement of the soil during times of heavy precipitation. As an example of this, in the Yukon-Tanana upland after the severe storms 2 years ago, numerous hillsides and valley bottoms underwent massive landsliding simply because of the heavy rainfall they received. Piping erosion or headward erosion into the subgrade. This is just natural headward erosion that reaches into the pipeline zone. It's already going on today. Warping or fracturing of deposits in front of advancing or surging glaciers. The pipeline is planned to be within less than a mile of several glacier terminuses, all of them in a zone of known glacial surging. The deposits in front of the glacier deform and crack much in front of the advancing ice surface. This poses a real hazard. Induced deformation, mass movement or melting, or diverted water, mud flow of fill from heavy rainstorms, artificial ponding, or diverted water in the fill. In other words, this is mass movement that would not have occurred if man had not put a different kind of material, such as the fill around the pipe, in place. There may be scour of the fill and subgrade by flooding action during times of high water. And then there's a third and basically different type of deformation that should be considered. This is strain that occurs in each second. Natural avalanching or of snow or rock material. Or there may be large-scale earthquake-induced landslides, slumping, avalanching, fault motion, and large amplitude ground waves, all of which are a hazard to the integrity. Induced severe motion may be caused by vandalism or sabotage. There may be negligent blasting, excavation, or attempted pipeline repair. There may be accidents such as boat, tractor, truck, aircraft, collision with the pipe itself. Prior to the installation and operation of a strain gauge network, the hazards must be identified so the gauges appropriate to those hazards are used. The data necessary to identify these hazards include air photos, drill logs, sample analyses, and detailed pipeline trench inspections. All of this data and subsequent interpretations must be preserved by both the industry and the government and made available to all having responsibility for pipeline integrity. The planned strain gauge network should be approved by both industry and government. Strain gauges to monitor slow deformation may consist of benchmarks tied to the pipe for resurveying, optically aligned targets on the pipe, or other such simple devices to be measured at yearly or longer intervals. Strain gauges to measure moderate deformation may be any electrical mechanical device installed on the pipe which can be interrogated or read at daily, weekly, or monthly regular inspection intervals. The inspection must not be subject to weather, for landsliding, avalanching, and mudflows are most common during storms than good weather. All of the data from the strain gauges and the interpretations of this data must be preserved and made available to the inspector and the industry. The interpretations from the strain gauges will be the key to the pipeline foundation maintenance program. The reason the records must be preserved for a long time is who's to know 50 years hence how much accumulated strain the pipeline has undergone if the original pipeline shape data is not available. Rapid deformation can lead to pipeline failure so quickly that interpretation of strain data by computer and a dispatcher, such as in Valdez, could not possibly precede rupture. Therefore, other gauges must be operated that will sense large magnitude earthquake shaking, avalanches near their source, and actual pipeline failure from any cause. These gauges must have a planned operational response. That is, they must automatically activate throttling and depressurization of the pipe in a sequence which will minimize the volume of spillage should a rupture occur. In other words, during a major earthquake, the dispatcher in Valdez may be struggling for his feet and totally incapable of making a command decision. Strict attention should be paid to the fact that electrical power and communications commonly fail during the very early moments of large magnitude earthquakes. Fail-safe, independently operating valving should be employed. Combination seismic and fluid pressure triggers operating self-powered valves could be in order if this is the optimum way of achieving this end. The valves would then be opened by command. The triggers and valves must be entirely self-contained, requiring no artificial stimulus or energy, and have a demonstrated high reliability. Attached with this testimony that I'll give to you is a proposed stipulation. I'm sure it will want to be reworded if it's considered.
Thank you very much. That's I think a very helpful analysis.
Your statement in the proposed stipulation will be marked as exhibit number 48. Thank you, Mr. Mayo. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Examiner, may I add one comment into the record? The use of transducers or pressure control valves as automatic chokes to cut off flow in pipelines is a well-known technology that has been practiced for many years, and I think it had been the intent of TAPS to place these at strategic points, right, just as on offshore or on land these are done. I think it's important to place that into the record. It is a known technology today.
Thank you, Mr. Mayo. The next witness is Charles Herbert, Anchorage, Alaska.
Mr. Secretary, member of the panel.
My name is Charles F. Herbert. I'm a consulting mining engineer. I live in Anchorage, but just at present I'm resident at a tumble-down bunch of cabins that suddenly become very famous. It's known as Live and Good. Actually, I live a few miles out of Live and Good on an also very famous atrocity called the Hickel Highway. However, I have nothing to do with the construction of the pipeline. In the past, I have been a chairman of the Alaska Public Service Commission and a deputy commissioner of the State Department of Natural Resources. And I accent the have been, which will indicate to a knowledgeable person that I'm a Democrat. Now, my purpose in appearing here this evening is to endorse Governor Miller's suggestion to the best that it can be implemented. My experience with regulation, of course, for many years being on the receiving end of regulations and being on them again, and then for a while being in that other position where we were making regulations and we were enforcing regulations, gives me quite a little thought about the problems that were advanced by the governor and his cabinet. I can speak somewhat more freely because the audience is thinned out and there are not too many people that are going to jump up and say, "Yeah, Herbert, remember what time when I wanted something." Now, I do think, also listening to the testimony that is here, as we know, there's some of it that is directly opposed to the construction of the pipeline, regardless of its economic advantages to the state or to the nation or anything else. Much of the opposition is actually phrased as, well, let us delay and delay and delay. And of course, some delay is naturally advisable. You can't go into a $1 billion project and just jump in and build it. You wouldn't actually do a lot of damage. There has to be a lot of regulation. It has to be given by the federal government or by the state, and probably by both. I don't see how both agencies, both governmental agencies, can avoid some responsibility in the matter. However, in this opposition, it reminds me somewhat of my own experience with regulation. It is so easy for a regulatory body, consciously or unconsciously, to thwart what might even be an accepted policy. It can be done, of course, as we all know, by delay in approval. Extra strict interpretation of a regulation or failure to write a regulation covering something that then has to be held up. Quite often, the delay can be affected even by an individual in a somewhat minor administrative post. I'm speaking from experience. I think that we had a good record in the state government, but it was not a perfect record. There were times when certainly some individual, through dislike of an individual or dislike of a particular action that was contemplated, might deliberately delay something that was necessary for that man's action. And of course, where we have highly seasonal operations in almost everything, that can, in effect, veto something that has already been approved. There are people who will, and honestly, desire that the North not be developed. I, again, listening to this conversation, the testimony rather this morning and this afternoon and evening, reminded of a time many years ago up in the Koyukuk in a remote cabin near Wiseman, where I had a very interesting long evening with a man whom all people who are familiar with the history of conservationism in this country will remember is Bob Marshall. Bob, of course, was an excellent man, a fine man, a true woodsman. He was a conservationist who knew that the outdoors meant something more than going out to mow the lawn, although I can't say that he and I always agreed on everything in that evening of conversation. He did, at that time, make it very clear his belief, and he did what he could to foster it and to get other people to agree with him, that all of Alaska north of the Yukon should remain untouched by any development. That was his thesis. He believed in it. He had his arguments for it. Now, that idea has not entirely died, and I feel that the pressure that may be brought by people who still believe as Bob, they may, through regulation, through pressure on perhaps an individual who has regulatory authority or even administrative authority, perhaps in a minor position, build up delays and delays and delays. Now, I do believe that the state, while not free of that, would possibly be in a better position to oppose it. And for that reason, I do endorse Governor Miller's stand. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Herbert. The next witness is John Clark, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, Warden, my name is John Clark. I'm a resident of Fairbanks for about 35 years. I'm not employed by any oil company, don't own any oil leases, nor am I employed by anybody doing any work for any oil companies or the pipeline people. However, I would like to say a little something in their defense, since I think the pipeline probably is a necessity if this part of the country is going to survive economically. I first became interested in this when I was reading about the possibility of this pipeline and what a terrible thing it was going to be for the environment of Alaska, especially the northern part. I wondered about this because I've spent considerable time north of the Yukon River, and it always seemed pretty well able to take care of itself to me, especially in the wintertime. So I got to reading these many articles in various conservation magazines and one thing and another, and I even saw where One gentleman wrote a long article saying that the caribou wouldn't be able to get across the pipeline. But it disturbed the moose. And I wondered about that because I've watched caribou swim the Yukon River by the thousands, taken many pictures of moose swimming the Yukon River. It seemed unreasonable that an animal that could cross a river 2 miles wide couldn't walk across a 4-foot pipe buried in the ground. Now, I may be wrong about that, but that's the way it seemed to me. To go a step further with this environment, if we were to lay a map on the floor here, 12 foot square, and lay a thread on it to scale over the pipeline route, that thread would be invisible. It would be so small. Now, that isn't really tearing up a real lot of the country. I've read and listened to these oil companies, the oil industry and the pipeline people answer the complaints of the conservationists, and it seems to me that they've agreed to go along with them in any way they could. They've agreed repeatedly. They've hired many of them to help them, ecologists, geologists, biologists, and everyone that's ever gone to see them that I've talked to, they've been real receptive to listen to whatever they had to say and discuss it with them. I'd like to say a little bit about this road that is being built to service the pipeline. Ever since I've been in Alaska, we've wanted a road to the Arctic, or to the North Slope, or to Nome, or someplace. But we're so poor, we never could even talk about it. Now we're going to get one for nothing. Better than we could possibly build, it's going to have a crushed rock surface, they tell me. Is that bad? Sounds awful good to me. I'd like to talk about the government in the North for a while. We've heard about this terrible pipeline bunch that's going to tear the country all to pieces. Our various government agencies have built installations from one end of this state to the other. They've built Nike sites, two line sites, missile sites, missile tracking sites, satellite light tracking sites, microwave sites, FAA sites, Air Force sites, Army sites, bombing ranges, rifle ranges, two pipelines. They've never heard anything, and they never made any effort not to. And that's the truth. When the Haines pipeline, the last one, was originally built, I worked there. The trucks had come up the highway, and they'd unload a load of pipe off of that truck onto the truck in the ditch here. They'd hook two tractors onto that truck and drag it along that pipeline right away. Mud rolling up over the fenders and over the top. Terrible looking sight. When they were through, they took a bulldozer and leveled it out, and you can't find it now. There's trees there as big around as your leg. I don't say that's the way this other pipeline should be built, but I'm talking about what the government did in this country. When the last war came, we built a pipeline, our government built a pipeline from Norman Wells to Fairbanks, and with a fork off of it that went to Watson Lake in Yukon Territory. We built a pipeline or a refinery in Whitehorse that cost $200 million, the pipeline and the refinery. We did all a crash program. As soon as the war was over, it was abandoned. Arctic contractors charged around on the North Slope for 8 years. They used every kind of a tracked vehicle known to man. They went 400 miles from one end of their travels to the other, drilled many wells, and you have a hard time finding where they'd been if it weren't for the gas barrels they left behind. The point I'd like to make here is I've heard all this, a great deal of complaint about this Trans-Alaska pipeline from many people on the public payroll. But I've never heard anybody, all the years I was here, I never heard anybody complain about these government projects here. I'd like to talk about the economics of the pipeline for a moment. At a minimum of 500,000 barrels a day, it'll produce $52 million a year in oil royalty to the state of Alaska. That's $150,000 a day, roughly. As you people know, Alaska is a depressed area. Has one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, and for every dollar we pay in federal income tax, we get $10 back from the government. A lot of us don't like that. We'd like to pack our own load and be, instead of meet, when we meet a friend from California or Washington or wherever, it always upsets me to have him say, well, how are things in the welfare state? So this pipeline's a chance, one chance for us to get on our feet and pay our own way, and I think the quicker it's built, the better it'll be. Now up here on the North Slope, we've got 23 million acres in the petroleum reserve. The Navy Petroleum Reserve. We've got 9 million acres in a wilderness area. There's 4 million acres up there that haven't been designated for sale yet that could be. Out of that, there's a total of a little over 50 million acres on the North Slope, and 72% of it is untouchable. It seems to me that that's a pretty good chunk for the conservationists when all we want is a little piece here about 100 miles long, along the coast, or less than that, really, about 70. I can't help but think that they have more than their fair share of the country now. I want to talk about the federal study now. I suppose I'll get in trouble. But I think it'd be a duplication of what the pipeline company has already done. I think to justify its existence, it'd probably make many changes that weren't necessary. And I think stomping around in the moss, they'd stomp on more moss and scare more mice than the actual building of the pipeline will. In closing, I'd like to say that I feel that this is an ideological conflict. It has nothing to do with ecology or environment, not that the pipeline don't have to be built to the standards that these people are required to build them to. But I figure this is a direct confrontation between a socialist type of government and a free enterprise type. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. The next witness is David Klein, Fairbanks, Alaska. Mr. Klein, present. Let the record show there's no response. The next witness is Terry Worrell, Fairbanks, Alaska. Is Terry Worrell present? The next witness on the list is Conrad Frank, Fairbanks, Alaska. Is Mr. Frank present? Let the record show there's no response. The next witness is John Carlson, Fairbanks, Alaska. Is Mr. Carlson present? Let the record show there's no response. The next witness is John Kelsey, Anchorage, Alaska.
Mr. Governor, if there is a session tomorrow, would you prefer to make a presentation at that time and not to submit it this month?
Are you ready to submit it at this time?
No, sir, we're not.
Do you have any objection if they submit it tomorrow? All right, we'll plan to submit it tomorrow morning then. The next witness on the list is Olaf Hjelfort. I won't pronounce the name again, I'll just ask if he's present. let the record show there's no response. The next witness is George Salidas, Fairbanks, Alaska. Mr. Salidas present? The record show there's no response. The next witness is Peggy Wayburn, California. She has previously indicated that she would like to testify tomorrow morning. The last witness on the list is Charles E. Belke, College, Alaska. All right, we'll plan to call him tomorrow morning then. If there's nothing further, and I assume there isn't, we will adjourn at this time and we'll begin at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Oh boy. The hearing will come to order. The first witness this morning is Ronald Anderson, University of Alaska student.
Mr. Mitch?
Yes.
Could I just note for the record that Congressman John Dingell is of Michigan is present in the audience this morning. Congressman Dingell is chairman of the Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee of the Committee on Emerging Marine and Fisheries of the House of Representatives, and we're very glad to have him with us and welcome him. And Congressman Dingell, if anything you'd like to add for the record, I hope you'll feel free to do so.
Secretary, it was not my purpose to add any comments to the record. I was pleased to note that you and the distinguished Assistant Secretary are up here to participate in this hearing. I think I could express to you my personal concern, the concern of the subcommittee that I share, that every reasonable measure should be utilized for the protection of the wonderful resources of this magnificent state and the construction of this pipeline.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, my name is Ronald Anderson, S-E-N. I'm a student at the University of Alaska and am speaking as a concerned citizen of this state. I don't claim to have any so-called, quote, expertise, end quote, on the ecology of the Arctic or on Arctic construction. Therefore, what I must say must be somewhat emotional. We have heard testimony that only facts should be presented to the panel. Well, my emotions are a fact. This testimony is an attempt to put my sincere feelings on the matter in question into words as well as I possibly can. I am opposed to the pipeline and to the further development of non-renewable resources north of the Yukon River, at least until such time as a reasonable amount of land is set aside as inviolate wilderness. This may sound selfish, and maybe it is, but I doubt that oil companies and other developers have been completely unselfish. It has been stated that the area involved in the North Slope oil exploration is small compared to the amount of wilderness remaining for the conservationists. Unfortunately, most of this area is not protected as wilderness. Not even the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is completely protected against oil exploration and development. Wilderness is not wilderness if it has a bunch of seismic lines running through it, or if it has an oil rig in the